always nice to have a good friend with me here on the show, and I've known Steve Lavin for a long time. He grew up in the San Francisco area, kind of a legend here, especially his father, who was a basketball coach as well. And, of course, he was the former head basketball coach at St. John's, two NCAA appearances with them, was also the head coach at UCLA, where he had a record of 145 wins and 78 losses, and was an assistant coach under Jim Herrick on UCLA's 1995 national championship team that won 32-1. And, of course, you probably see him on Fox Sports and Fox Sports 1, where he does color commentating on college basketball and also works with CBS Turner during the tournament, Pac-12 tournament, or I should say network as well. Steve, we haven't talked for a while, and it just seems like the world is moving fast, and particularly in collegiate sports. When you think about, you know, when you got into this and look at where we are now, what is the thing that shocks you the most about where we are in college athletics?
Well, good question. My first year in Division I basketball was 1988, going back a ways, the Purdue Boilermakers under Gene Cady in the Big Ten. I'd say the biggest differences are, one, the popularity, the growth of the sport of college basketball, the venues being played in the domes, and worldwide basketball now, similar to the way soccer is so popular. And now with media, with the information age, the 24-hour news cycle, and, of course, electronics, the smartphones, that's changed the business in terms of recruiting, in terms of young people's ability to build their own brand. We've got basketball players like Lonzo Ball that have more followers on Instagram than the University of California, Los Angeles, or the site of UCLA Athletics. And those are unique dimensions, kind of a revolution. And I think we're just trying to get a handle on exactly what's happened. It's been a bit of a big bang in the last 10 years when it comes to information and sport and entertainment.
Big money, good or bad for college athletics?
Well, I think like every industry, it presents the challenges of once money's involved, it becomes more complicated. And the original amateur model has gone through some transformations, and it needs to evolve, similar to the Olympic model that changed in the 70s and 80s to kind of come up to speed to stay competitive. And I think college athletics is examining and trying to figure out how to best tweak the system as these changes occur at such a rapid rate.
I was talking to Mark D'Antonio. He was in the seat where you were sitting, the head football coach at Michigan State, and he's been around the game for a long time. And I asked him, I said, how comfortable are you as a coach today in college football? And he paused, and I could see the frown on his forehead and everything. I mean, I think about when you got into it and Gene Cady, was coaching as well. Has the joy gone out of coaching college athletics, particularly college basketball maybe?
Well, I do think it's more challenging to carve out the meaningful aspects of teaching and coaching because of the big business aspect. And there's always been a degree of business, but now it's become more dominant because of the revenue streams, the pressure to win. And so we have less people coaching that came up as teachers. You know, John Wooden started as an English teacher. Dayton High School before moving on to South Bend Central High School and then a Division II school, Indiana State, before coming out west. And he also had a stint in the service with the Navy somewhere in there as well. So, you know, most of the coaches in the era of the 50s and 60s and 70s, their background was in education. And often they taught history or English, some subject. And they really understood the laws of learning in terms of teaching and instructing, and that influenced their coaching. And now a number of coaches get into the business because of recruiting and their ability to recruit players, to acquire talent or personnel, and not making a judgment on it. But clearly, if you have people like a Pete Newell or a John Wooden, who had backgrounds in education that went into coaching. And now we've got people that have a background in recruiting, more of the sales aspect. That's going to be played out, and it's going to have an influence on the game and teaching.
Yeah, I know when you were at UCLA, listen to these names out there, folks. Matt Barnes, Baron Davis, Ryan Hollins, Jason Capono, and also Earl Watson, just to name a few on the UCLA teams. Those are people that you recruited. And I've talked to Mike Krzyzewski about this so much. I asked him, I said, you have a reputation of not screwing up a kid when you get him into the program. I said, what do you look for? And he said, when I go into a recruit's home, it may be a single parent or a double parent. He said, I always make sure I ask the parents a question, and then I look out of the corner of my eye to see whether the recruit is rolling his eyes or not. I said, what does that tell you? He says, that they respect authority. And he says, you don't see that very much. Now, you take a look at what's happened in college basketball with recruiting. I mean, it is a mess. How did we get to this point?
Well, I think you get back to a culture where there is such an emphasis on the winning and the revenue streams that are created as a result of being able to win games. And even winning helps with enrollment at universities. The branding of universities is enhanced when a team like Gonzaga has a 20-year run, as they have. That's helped their university in a number of ways, not just athletics. So I think once there's that pressure to win and that emphasis is on winning and the bottom line and creating revenue streams, whether it's the football bowl games or the NCAA tournament basketball games, and coaches are evaluated on their ability to win and win quickly. And if they're not able to, they're going to be terminated or fired. So that message, I think, across the board creates some real dilemmas. And there's some inherent challenges with that. And so that's what's led to people pushing the envelope in recruiting, because they want to win games and keep their job and get a contract extension. And as a result, oftentimes get themselves in a bind in terms of the NCAA or, in this case, the FBI.
Yeah, there's a lack of morality to be quite and now that's from my perspective all of this. Because if you take a look at the athletic apparel companies, the shoe companies, I mean, they played into this as well. Once you throw money out there, it's going to corrupt. It is easily going to corrupt. And that's what we've got right now in college sports, college basketball particularly.
Yeah, and I think there were elements or aspects that have always been in play in terms of pushing the envelope, but the scrutiny is greater now, and just higher levels of dollars because of the involvement of shoe companies, agents, television networks. We're talking about billions of dollars that are in play when it comes to college athletics. And so, again, we're in the midst of a revolution, and there needs to be some evolution. And at any point in our history, aside from athletics, that's kind of a cyclical thing that's happened before when we look at human nature and we look at our country.
And the thing, Steve, is that I've talked to other college basketball coaches, people that are well-respected, and they have told me, we've known this has been going on forever. And I don't see being able to put the horse back into the corral, do you?
Well, not in terms of the way the model currently exists. If it's tweaked, I don't think we're going to get to a point where student-athletes are being paid for their performance. I do think there may be an opportunity to provide dollars for those student-athletes that are in need based on financial need and hardship and the socioeconomic implications that often are in play when it comes to football and basketball in particular. Maybe doesn't impact the Olympic sports in the same way, tennis and golf and swimming and gymnastics, but when it comes to men's football, men's basketball, probably track and field to some degree, and women's basketball, baseball as well, but again, to varying degrees, when student-athletes, members of the NCAA, have financial need, I think based on the financial need, there is the opportunity to provide dollars, not, again, based on their performance. It has to be equal in terms of gender and be on both the men's and the women's side. But I do think there's some thinking, and people are now realizing that something has to be done because of the amount of dollars that are coming into the NCAA.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, we got 25 seconds before we have to break here. Are you optimistic, pessimistic, or still in the middle on whether this thing can get back on track in a way that everybody will be satisfied with it?
Yeah, I think we will navigate through and will reinvent because of necessity to do so. So I'd say I'm still optimistic, but I'm also a realist and pragmatic in terms of how we're going to get to that optimistic view. It's going to take some work.
Steve Lavin is with us in the studio. We're talking about college athletics, college basketball, and he certainly knows about both since he was the head coach at St. John's, also the head coach at UCLA, where he had a record of 145 wins and 78 losses. We continue across the country and around the world. We've got you on Sports Byline. Steve Lavin is with us on Sports Byline, longtime basketball coach. And as I pointed out, he was the head basketball coach at St. John's and also the head basketball coach at UCLA. Let me ask you about the St. John's experience for just a second. You're a West Coast guy, and yet you went back to St. John's in New York. What was the culture like for basketball as compared to the West Coast?
I really enjoyed it, and I've had the opportunity starting at Purdue to be in the Midwest, where fans in Indiana are fanatical about the game, coaching in the Big Ten under Gene Katie, and then being out west in the Pac-12, or what was the Pac-10, now the Pac-12, the opportunity to learn from Coach Wooden, who was still with us at that point, and then going back east. And like comparative literature, they're different, but I enjoyed all three, and all were wonderful experiences for the differences. New York, the fans are intelligent. They love good basketball. There's the history there going back to LIU and CCNY and NYU, and then obviously the Knicks and those great teams in the 70s that passed the ball. When you look at Bradley and DeBuscher and Frazier and Phil Jackson, Willis Reed. So Red Holtzman had such a great influence on those Knicks teams. And so fans appreciate whether it's a backdoor, whether it's great defense, a two-man game playing in pairs or playing in a tandem, great passing. And so coaching in the Garden, having the opportunity to be the head coach of St. John's and your home court be in Madison Square Garden was just another one of those pinch me, am I dreaming moments in this 30-plus year run, the love affair with basketball. So grateful for my time. We were fortunate to go out with an NCAA tournament in 2015. Sometimes when you're given the door, it's because you've had a bad season. In our case, we were able to leave feeling good about what we had done during my time there. So, and now Chris Mullen's got them going this year. They're 9-0 unbeaten.
Yeah. Let me talk to you a little bit about a blue chip type of player and the battle amongst coaches to be able to get somebody like that. We're talking about an 18-year-old kid. Maybe coming out of a difficult socioeconomic situation. You've got parents, you've got people whispering in their ears and everything. What is that experience like for a coach to have to deal with things that they really have no control over?
Yeah, it's a scenario where you want to be real, be genuine, be authentic. It starts when they're 15, 16 years old, sometimes even younger, when kids are coming to your camps or when you're in a place like UCLA or St. John's in an urban center, kids are coming up and coming to games and they're around the offices starting at a very young age. So you get to know them, similar to being a playground director back in the day when kids would hang out at the playground. So authentic, straightforward, trying being as direct as possible, but also having some empathy for the difficult backgrounds that some of these young people come from. And so we always tried to be forthright and talk about what we could do and what we can't do. And it's not always the answer that a family wants to hear. And also big picture, you know, I was someone that was fortunate to come up in a family where education was important. And my father was a lifelong teacher. And so really emphasizing to the young people, beginning with recruiting before they even got to campus, how basketball in its purest form can be the ideal metaphor for life, to learn the values and virtues that will sustain beyond the sport itself when you get into the next chapter of your life, when you've got to work for a living. And so we really emphasized that. It wasn't just lip service. And that's the fun part of getting older now in my mid-50s, seeing a Bob Myers as a general manager of the Golden State Warriors, or Sean Farnham on ESPN as a broadcaster, or Earl Watson doing wonderful things as a coach and in the community. So some of the proudest moments in coaching are not necessarily the wins and losses. Again, it sounds cliche, but it's watching your former players move into different industries and make a difference, a significant or meaningful difference in other people's lives.
University of San Diego coach Jim Brevelli is a friend of mine, coached at USF, of course, when they brought the program back as well. And I remember talking to him and asking him, when you went into a recruit's house, what was the first question they always asked you? And he said was, hey, coach, how many times are we going to be on television? Now, that's passe because everybody is on television now. But as you were recruiting, what was the most asked question you always got?
Well, oftentimes the grandmother or the mother would ask about the graduation rate and about the academic support that was in play in terms of tutors, in terms of when we're on the road, who's proctoring those exams, the flexibility of the faculty to work with student athletes, difficult schedule because the demands that are placed upon a student athlete as opposed to a regular student that's matriculating through the years at a college or a university. So the father oftentimes would ask about the system or the style of play and wanted to see the track record of players in the NBA and the kind of success they had had, would ask more of the questions that had to do with the sport itself. And the student athlete wanted to know in a similar fashion about, you know, the team, the style of play, player development, what's the training methods year round in terms of trying to get the most out of his potential or get him closer to his full potential as a student athlete.
I'm laughing and smiling here a little bit because you know where I'm going with this next. Well, coach, how much am I going to get paid this year? And what about my dad? Can he have a job in the athletic department? And I know it goes on. I've had guys tell me what they were offered. I've had some football players that were with the 49ers. I said, what were you offered? He says, well, I won't tell you who offered it to me, but I was offered a lot. You know, I just don't know how coaches counter that sort of thing. You go in with an honest message, and yet you've got other people that are whispering in the ears, and especially with people, hey, if you go to this school or that school wearing our sneaker, then, you know, we're going to help you as well. I mean, I don't know how you do it.
Yeah, the battles now start early, too, in terms of the shoe companies and even agents and financial advisors prior to a prospect even arriving on a college campus. There's involvement and recruiting in those different, you know, realms of shoe companies and sports agents and financial advisors. So it's a very complicated landscape to navigate. And you kind of do the best you can. I think the creative aspects have been in play, you know, maybe different. What used to be a hog farmer that you would go see now might be, you know, someone that's in some other industry. But that element of support outside of the program, but someone that has an interest in the program, I think that's been in play going back decades.
The one thing I've always wondered is how does a coach plan? Because you and I both know when you started, you went out and recruited a kid. Hey, I'm going to have him three, probably 4 years, and now it's one and done. I think about Mike Krzyzewski down at Duke and with the great players he's had there, and I think Kyrie Irving was the first player that he lost to going out of Duke early. But now you can't think in terms of a four years with a particular player. How does that, doesn't that throw everything off as far as trying to develop a program or develop a team?
Yeah, it's a real challenge because naturally, in its purest form, the mission and aims of university should be to, you know, help a young person grow and develop in all aspects of their life and ultimately earn a degree, which will put them on a more positive trajectory in terms of a career path. But it's challenging when you've got a number of players that are either playing a year or two and leaving, or they're transferring to another school. We have the alarming rates now in terms of transfers, but it's also created opportunities like free agency, but in college for teams to stock up and have success in a very short period of time. Nevada right now is having great success under Eric Musselman, and they have 10 transfers on their roster. So St. John's has 8 transfers on their roster. So it's a complicated, again, time in college athletics. And coaches just adjust to the rules and figure out a way to be competitive and put together a team that can win games, because they know if they don't, they're going to be fired. And that's what's going on right now with this remarkable, kind of troubling trend of so many transfers.
How do you see the G League proposal of playing an athlete $125,000? How will that change the college basketball landscape? Guys now that can go out and make some money before they even go to college at all.
Well, there's two elements to it. One element is if someone has no interest in getting an education, they either don't feel they have the faculties or the abilities, or they just don't have any motivation to get a college degree. The fact there's an opportunity for them to continue to pursue basketball as a way to make a living, and they don't have an interest in school whatsoever, good for them. Then there's the thing that the NCAA needs to be mindful of, which is continuing to explore creative ways to make college basketball and getting an education attractive enough so that we don't lose some of those prospects that, if they arrived on a college campus, would begin to see the value. Because part of what happens is when you get on a college campus, the idea is you begin to grow and see the world through a different lens or prism and connect with teachers and counselors and teammates and coaches. And as a result, it opens up another world that you didn't know existed as a young person. So I think it's important that we get them on a college campus, and that can be a game changer, kind of a new paradigm. Even if they didn't know coming in how much they're going to enjoy college, they're more likely to stay in school, get their degree, or come back after playing 2 or 3 years and then having a professional career, but return to that school to finish their degree.
Let's talk about John Wooden, because I know how much he meant to you, and you were the head coach at UCLA, would interact with him. Bill Walton, I've talked to others that certainly played for him and everything, and I think we all have. In your case, and the players, they have many memories, but mine was once covering the NCAA Final Four at the LA Forum, and it was a semifinal game in which UCLA had won, and I ran into Coach in the hallway. He was looking at the stat sheet, and I said, "Coach, what do you think?" He says, "You know, Ron," he says, "turnovers in basketball are like walks in baseball. They'll kill you every time."
True.
There was something solid about him. I don't know if he would work today, you know, his style and everything. It probably would not work, knowing the societal situation we have today. But there was a foundation there that was good for everything. What was that basic foundation of John Wooden?
Well, I think his Midwest upbringing, having great parents, and the fact that he stayed with the important sustainable values and virtues that go into achievement. And whether it's preparation, whether it's respect, loyalty, critical thinking, decision-making, making good judgments. And so he was someone that was interested and had an insatiable appetite to learn. And that's what allowed him to sustain success in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s. And really, we haven't seen anyone like him in sport in terms of how dominant he's been, or how dominant he was as a coach. And I think his open-mindedness, he continued to take a psychology class in the spring each year when he was working at UCLA. He'd sit in on those psychology classes because he knew the key to his success was going to be motivating young people. And to do that, he had to keep up with the latest in terms of the trends in psychology and how to bring out the best in young people. So whether it was Cervantes, Martin Luther King, Abraham Lincoln, Winston Churchill, he was always drawing from great minds because he was interested and had that desire to continue to learn, to elevate and enhance his own teaching methods to make a better experience for both individual players, but also building or molding winners.
We got about 45 seconds left. When you think back over your career as a coach and as a player as well, is there any one moment that's kind of etched into Steve Lavin's mind?
John Wooden would play a part in it. I think mentors like Gene Cady, the time spent with him, learning from Bobby Knight, Mike Krzyzewski, the time with Coach Wooden, the national championship with Jim Herrick and great staff there, Mark Gottfried, Lorenzo Romar, and wonderful young student athletes at that time, Tyus Edney, the O'Bannon brothers, George Zedek from the Czech Republic. And then there's those pinch me moments where you realize you're the head coach at UCLA or you're the head coach at St. John's or you're working alongside Brent Musburger in television. And the sense of gratitude and really being humbled, but also the message I give to young people is that if you do the right thing and you treat people with respect and you treat the game with respect, it will return and take you to some special places like this, hanging out with you on
Steve, on an
afternoon here in San Francisco.
Well, I thank you for that, my friend. Now that you're living in San Francisco, we have to get together more often. Take care.
No doubt. Enjoyed it.
Steve Lavin with us, former head basketball coach at St. John's and also at UCLA. We continue across the country and around the world. It's good to have you with us on America's Sports Talk Show, Sports Byline.